Good morning, and welcome to the Sunday edition for November the 27th, 2011. I'm Michael Enright. In 1876, the Ontario government opened an institution for people with a developmental disability near Orillia, 90 minutes north of Toronto. It was originally called the Orillia Asylum for Idiots. Later, in more enlightened times, it became the Huronia Regional Centre. At its peak in 1968, it housed 2,600 residents. It was one of 16 such institutions in the province, which over the generations were homed to 50,000 people. The last of them was closed in 2009. Parents were told that their children would be cared for, that it was, all in all, the best thing for them. It is now coming to light that this was not the case. For the first time, adults who grew up in these places are telling harrowing stories of abuse and neglect. And we begin our program this morning with a special documentary by David Gutnick about Huronia and the people who lived and suffered there. It is called The Gristle in the Stew. In our middle hour, last week's examination of cancer charities prompted a ton of mail from you and a host of questions. Why isn't more money spent on prevention? What about cancer caused by toxins in the environment? Are we winning or losing the war on cancer? This morning, we seek out the answers with two oncologists. That's in our second hour. In hour three, a conversation with Ariel Dorfman about tyranny, exile, and the power of memory. The author of Death and the Maiden, Dorfman was forced to flee for his life when the CIA-backed coup toppled the government of Chilean leader Salvador Allende. The burden of its history haunts him still. Elsewhere, Canadian playwright Judith Thompson with her Winter's Tale, some thoughts on Toronto hatred, and the motorcycle madman Charlie Borman. The Sunday edition on CBC Radio 1. There was a time in this fair land when to admit to being born and brought up in Toronto was like admitting to serial adultery or to playing the accordion. People either dripped sarcasm all over the conversation or sneered with a withering self-righteousness. Toronto was smug. Toronto was unfriendly. Toronto was money mad. Toronto was joyless. All true in the Toronto of my growing up. It was a closed, pinched, claustrophobic society governed and guided by waspy foofs, or fine old Ontario families. It was snow white where it wasn't orange, and proud of it. There was a whiff of anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism in the air. My father could still remember the days of the Nina signs downtown, "No Irish need apply." There were no good restaurants. The culinary highlight was the rice pudding at Murray's. Sundays were all about church. No stores, few sports, not much of anything. Boredom was considered a civic virtue. No wonder I could not wait to get out. But that was 40 years ago. Immigration changed everything. In the 1950s, Italians, Hungarians, Jamaicans, East Indians, Chinese, dozens of different nationalities flooded the city and changed it completely and forever. It became less monocolor. Almost overnight, you could find decent restaurants with exciting menus. The character of the city changed. The city opened up. Its people, for the most part, embraced the newness of everything, to the point where, as the cliche goes, it became the most multicultural city in the world. It is now a city of more than 2 million people, with all the travails and triumphs that that entails. And we are still hated by the rest of the country. Recently, the firm of Leger Marketing conducted a poll for the National Capital Commission and the Association of Canadian Studies. The poll asked about 2,500 Canadians what they thought of certain cities. Nearly 20% of the people polled had higher negatives for Toronto than for any other city. They favored any other city over Toronto. Much of the resentment was in the West. Some 30% of Albertans hated Toronto, 27% in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, and 23% in British Columbia. I suppose the West's anti-Toronto prejudices are rooted in the myths and myths of history. Eastern banks, Eastern railroads, National Energy Plan, Bay Street Barons, they all have a kind of Toronto tinge. Part of it is envy, the kind of schoolyard envy that kids have for the biggest kid in the yard, which is odd. Toronto lost its smugness decades ago. It had to. There is a lot wrong with the city. Its infrastructure, its roads and bridges are reminiscent of pre-1989 Albania. The transit system is collapsing under its own weight. Traffic is gridlocked almost from morning to night. And the governance of the city makes ultimate fighting seem like the Kirov ballet. Architecturally, it is a mess. We have more high-rise condos under construction than any other city in North America. And we manage somehow to uglify a beautiful natural waterfront with mile after mile of sterile condos cutting the downtown off from the harbor. Marcus G., the excellent urban affairs columnist for the Globe and Mail, has pointed out that for all its faults, Toronto is still safer in terms of crime than any other city in the country. G says that what Canadians feel about Toronto is not unlike what some adolescent boys feel for a big brother. As he writes, quote, most boys grow out of it. Canadians should too.
Find yourself in people's city. Stay a while if you can with folks who will be tomorrow's faces, kicking the traces, showing you places in Toronto. That's people's city, where love takes hold, makes old dreams happen. She makes you feel things, so buried feelings take on old meaning. In Toronto, that's people's city.
Doctor, can't you give her something to calm her down?
I'll give her sedative. But I think the best thing to give both of you right now is the truth. Mental retardation can happen in any family, Bob. There is a retarded child on every street.
Now, what can we do for Betty?
Someday we may have to see about putting her under the care of one of the Ontario hospital schools.
You mean in an institution?
Well, you can call it that if you like. I prefer to think of these places as communities where a child can be happy.
Progress and happiness. These are the key words.
That is from a 1960s Ontario government film called One on Every Street. It was shown regularly to parents of intellectually disabled children back then. The goal was to reassure them and to persuade parents that committing their children to the care of an institution for the mentally retarded, as these children were known, was the best thing they could do. Their children would be well cared for.
Yeah.
Rob was first diagnosed with, quote, mental retardation. Eventually, our family doctor said, why don't you put Rob in the institution, have another child, and forget about him? No one called us to say, Rob has had an accident. His nose is broken. He's got scars on his body where he shouldn't have scars. I'm pretty sure he was raped. And I knew it was awful, but I figured, I believed them. I said, okay, this will happen. I may be home and he'll go to school.
Muriel Grace is fully convinced that her son and thousands of other children were neglected and abused in these institutions. Her son Rob can't speak out, but plenty of other former residents can. And for the first time, their tales of childhood in Ontario's institutions for the intellectually impaired are being told. Those tales are harrowing. The children who grew up in these institutions are middle-aged men and women now, and they are looking for recompense. They have launched class-action lawsuits against the province of Ontario. They are asking for $3 billion in damages to be split among 12,000 former residents and their families. This is the largest legal action on behalf of the intellectually disabled ever undertaken in Canada. And it started with two women, Patsy Seth and Marie Slark. Today they live independently in downtown Toronto, but they grew up at Huronia, the oldest and biggest Ontario institution for the intellectually impaired, in Orillia, a couple of hours north of Toronto. Here is David Gutnick's documentary, The Gristle in the Stew. There is some language in this story that may offend some listeners.
A lot of people still got inside their shell. They would not speak out for their right. So I'm proud to help them out.
We were graded.
I was considered more on intelligence.
The counselor held me upside down, holding my legs, and my face was right underneath the water.
Make them pay what they did to us.
It was like drowning.
Some people say I'm goopy. Some people say I am dumb.
Hello, Patricia?
Hi. This is awesome!
How are you?
I just came out! My name's Pat. Yeah,
I'm Pat. I'm David.
Yeah,
so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Dave.
So how are you?
Not bad.
So you live right around here?
Well, not this building, but the next one with the underpass. They call it the Annex. What's your name again?
David.
David. Surprise! Ready with that microphone?
Patricia Seth has a mess of thick blonde hair, is a little over 5 feet tall, and is stocky, like a bulldog. This morning, her black nylon purse is tightly zipped and strapped around her neck.
We're going out to Orillia today.
Yes.
You don't mind going back?
I don't mind going back today.
It's going to bring back memories.
But that should help with the class action suit. I love it down here.
Patricia lived in Huronia Regional Center in Orillia for 14 years.
It was a bad place. Once you see what I'm talking about, you'll know. Do you have the keys to get in, or does somebody have to let you in? It might be boarded up.
Huronia, where Patricia spent her childhood, has been around since 1876. Back then, it was called the Orillia Asylum for Idiots, the first institution built for the intellectually disabled. It was a victory for the eugenics movement that wanted the disabled removed from mainstream society. Over the years, more and more parents were encouraged to send their disabled children to Orillia. Shoe repair and sewing workshops were added, a nurse's residence, a working farm with cows and chickens. Local people worked as cleaners and cooks and guards. It was Orillia's largest employer. By the 1960s, it was widely agreed that one in 33 children was intellectually disabled. One on every street. The title of the government film shown to their parents.
We speak of retarded children, and this is correct. The infants grow and look like adults, but mentally they will always remain children, and they must be treated and cared for as children for the rest of their lives.
In 1964, Patricia Seth was six, a blonde, frustrated, disabled whirlwind. Her parents decided they could no longer keep her at home. They packed up the car, drove to Orillia, and dropped their middle daughter off at the admissions office. They were encouraged not to visit.
I always said to Mom and Dad, when can I come back home? But they never gave me a straight answer. They said that I would be there till I died.
My name's Marie Slark, and I went into Aurelia when I was 7, and I got discharged in February of 1974. I'm 57 years old.
Marie and Patricia have been friends for almost 50 years. Patricia is the energetic, bold one. Marie is shy. When Patricia and Marie were little girls, they ate at the same long tables, ran around the same courtyard, and slept in the same crowded dormitory. Now, they have their names on the front page of the same class action lawsuit.
So you would have done virtually anything.
My name's Jim Dolmage. I'm one of the litigation guardians in the class action lawsuit. Litigation guardian is a role supporting the two women, Patsy and Marie, who are the lead plaintiffs in the case.
Jim Dolmage is a retired high school teacher. His wife, Marilyn, is a social worker. Her younger brother died in Huronia. And that's where Marilyn decided to work. Patricia and Marie were two of her clients. After the two women left Huronia, that was more than 30 years ago, they all stayed in touch. They became friends. Patricia moved to Hamilton and back, married and divorced. Marie had passed her driver's license. She owned a car, had a job.
And it's only the last few years that we really learned all of the things that went on in the institution and the things that happened to them.
I never told anybody about my past.
No.
One lady came to me and asked me, oh, were you ever in an institution? And I wouldn't tell her.
But I would have learned a lot.
But Marie and Pat trusted the Dolmages. They talked around the supper table. The stories they told about Huronia were more and more shocking. They told of beatings, of being locked in dark cupboards. They were 8, 9, 10 years old.
Like one staff made us, if we were talking, get up in the playroom, pull our pants down, and walk around the playroom with our pants down.
One of the counselors put my head under hot water. I pulled back like this, broke my tooth so fast because I was a little girl at the time. I'm telling you the truth.
Patsy's a fighter, and she stood up for herself, and in an institution that does not work. So she was abused. But if she'd said anything, the abuse would have gotten even worse. And it was that that led me to the understanding that this was systemic.
You know that there are problems all along, and you think of other ways to deal with them. But the idea of a class action didn't occur to us.
Could we, should we do anything? It's the old thing. If good people don't speak up, nobody will.
The Prime Minister with the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
3 years ago, when the Dolmages heard about the Aboriginal residential school apology, they began thinking that maybe a class action was the way to help Patricia and Marie.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children...
Marie and Pat, you didn't want to speak to people. You didn't want your names used at first, and we worked really hard to protect that. But as you met people who admired your courage, you found so much more support, and you're feeling sad about that?
I'm sad in the respect that it brings back bad memories. But at the same time, I'm kind of happy about it. Because justice is being done and everything...
Jim and Marilyn found a Toronto law firm that had been involved in the residential school lawsuit. Patricia Seth and Marie Slark began spending their days with lawyers, slowly digging back into their Huronia memories, adding detail upon detail. It was as though they were all taking a course called Class Action 101.
The class,
action is a group of people that get together and...
We want the government to admit that we were neglected.
Nobody asked to be born retarded.
It was a crime back then to be retarded.
They're stuck in a building that's like a prison.
We were sentenced for a crime that we didn't commit.
Kirk Bayart is the lawyer leading the class action suit.
They have no way of getting in touch with their family members. They're subject to the complete authority and whim of those who are taking care of them, who decide how much they get to eat, who decide what time they go to bed, who decide when they're punished. Everybody is really quick to advise others, especially vulnerable people who've been treated badly by the state, to forget about it and just put it behind them. Most people don't do that.
When Patsy would speak up, she would get into more trouble. And I would keep quiet about it. I knew what the consequences would have been.
The mildly retarded girls are given regular cooking classes and acquire a skill that will help them anywhere, in or out of the school community. Not all the patients are able to feed themselves, and some cannot be taught to chew. So special food must be prepared for them.
We were the gristle in the stew. That was unwanted.
Along with Patricia and Marie, more than 1,800 other people lived in Huronia. All of them vulnerable, most of them children. When you drive into Orillia, you can't miss it. A massive three-story red brick building sits in the middle of a vast lawn. A dozen other buildings are scattered about the grounds. Rows of majestic oaks and maples stretch down to Lake Simcoe.
Oh my God! God. That's residence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I hate it! I'm sorry.
I hate this place too.
Woo!
We slowly drive by empty building after empty building.
There's admissions. That's where I first went.
Yeah.
It is cold out here. If I'd have known, I would have brought my jacket.
We walk to the front of the main building. The women look up to the third floor windows, where they stared out at the world when they were little girls.
You got a star each day that you were well behaved.
Childhood memories come flooding back.
But if you were even a little bit bad, you either got a quarter of a black mark, a half of a black mark, or a full black mark. Most of us, me, got black marks every day. We would have to face each other. Move back a little bit and I'll show you. A little bit more. Okay, like that. And we had to go through on our hands and knees, and we all got slapped on the back.
And they made us dig worms. That means laying on the ground with your face on the ground, your hands behind your back.
If you turned your head this way or that way, one of them would come by and put their foot on like this, right down. And you know, when I told my father that, he'd tell me I was exaggerating. He would say, "You're just adding to the story." Every
How
time.
How do you know when he's not here?
Did a lot of people not believe you?
I would tell my dad about it when he would come up, and he came up the three times I was here. And he would make excuses for them.
Did you tell your social workers?
You couldn't.
You can't leave the cottage. How would you sneak out? The doors were locked.
I remember when I met you.
One person missing, the friggin' horn would go off.
A few years before Patricia and Marie arrived at Huronia, the well-known journalist Pierre Burton paid a quiet visit. He wrote what became an infamous column for the Toronto Star. It was called, "What's Wrong at Orillia? Out of Sight, Out of Mind." Burton visited on New Year's Eve, 1959. A friend was bringing his 12-year-old son back after the Christmas holidays, and Burton tagged along. He saw 90 beds crammed into a room built for 70. On one ward, there was a bathtub, three showers, and a row of eight toilets for 144 residents. Burton wrote that the stench of urine and feces was appalling. He went on to say that the century-old buildings were fire traps and that dozens of children could die in a major blaze. Burton ended his article with this. After Hitler fell, many Germans excused themselves because they said they did not know what went on behind those walls. No one had told them. Well, said Burton, you have been told about Orillia.
They were always complaining that we would lose our temper and abuse them. It was the other way around.
Marie's shoulders sag as she catches Marilyn's eye.
When I met you, I was wondering, when am I going to get out of here? Remember?
I think a few people who were staff here were aware how unhappy you were. And they were aware that you could do much more than you were showing anybody you could do. Especially with crafts and knitting and that sort of thing. Marie's really excellent. So they kind of put the word forward that she should leave. So there were a couple of staff who were looking out for you. Pat, probably they didn't do that right away because you were acting out all the time and you were seen as somebody who needed the discipline.
We were told to eat everything on our plate. And I got punished when I didn't eat everything on my plate. I would get turned upside down in the hopper with the cold water turned on my face.
What, someone would hold
you
upside down?
Well, the counselor held me upside down, holding my legs, and my face was right underneath the water. It was like drowning.
Burton's article ignited a public debate over the treatment of the intellectually disabled in Ontario's institutions.
These children are part of my job. I'm Dr. Diamond, Minister of Health for the province of Ontario.
The provincial government admitted there were problems and promised to invest more money and improve conditions.
My department is working hard to solve the problem of overcrowding in the Ontario hospital schools. Not so simple, you see.
Then, in 1971, two intellectually impaired young men, both former residents of a provincial institution, died. Frederick Elijah Sanderson hanged himself. Jean-Marie Martel froze to death. Public outrage was reignited. The government had to do something. Lawyer Walter Williston was appointed to look into everything about care and treatment of the intellectually disabled.
For at least 100 years, the mentally retarded had been put on the bottom of the barrel.
Williston concluded the entire system was outdated and broken. It was time, he said, for a century of failure and inhumanity to come to an end.
Parents were discouraged from ever even seeing their children.
Williston recommended increased community support and the phasing out of all institutions.
The changeover from the old thinking.
In response, the government did come up with plans to gradually close institutions. Very gradually. It was, after all, a political minefield. Thousands of union jobs would be lost. Residents' families were terrified. Where would their family members live? Who would pay the caregivers? It took the province more than 40 years to close down all the institutions. Meanwhile, the evidence of abuse within those institutions kept growing. Staff were charged with assaulting children. Over-medicated teenagers ended up in hospital. There were suicides. Funding for community living programs was increased. But hundreds of children were still living behind locked doors. Heronia did not close until 2009. Patricia and Marie left Heronia in the 70s. They were both 21. An unlocked door. For the first time in 30 years, Patricia and Marie are back inside.
Oh my God! Oh my God! This was the canteen! We came in this door from the outside sometimes, depending on what... And we would just go up, we would get a 5-cent bag of cheesies.
I remember getting pop, chips.
We would get canteen money and be able to come to the canteen once a week as a privilege. Don't worry, it's okay.
We wander endless hallways, room after room of peeling beige paint and scruffy tiles. Patricia tries the elevator.
Wait a minute, let's see.
The door slides open to a hallway of classrooms.
Yeah.
This is where Patricia and Marie went to school.
That's right, it was. I'm pretty sure of it.
Put your tongue between your teeth, please. Birthday.
The government's information film, One on Every Street, was filmed in rooms like these. The camera carefully shows little girls in white blouses and navy blue jumpers learning how to behave, how to be polite.
Yes, they had programs for us, like dances and birthday parties. Like, I remember being in the children's dorm, we were always having birthday parties. I loved the cake with the pink icing, but I didn't like the rest of the food.
When we went to the bathrooms,
there were no dividers. So
no door whatsoever.
And look in.
I don't think there were
even. We could see each other, you know. And if you even looked at them the wrong way, you were told to scrub the floor on your hands and knees. You had a rubber pad underneath your knees, mind you. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say it's all bad, but I gotta tell the truth. You gotta call a spade a spade.
And if we were caught swearing, they would put make us drink formaldehyde.
And that burns.
And that made me feel like I wanted to throw up.
Formaldehyde is a sedative that dates from the mid-1800s. Nurses were giving the same drug to Patricia and Marie a century later.
How much did you have to drink, Marie, if you don't mind me asking? Just a little bit? It's clear like water and it burns. I remember that. See how it's coming back? There was nowhere to turn. Nobody listened. And we got warned that if we tried to report it to the outside, we would get punished when we got back. And they would get the other kids to abuse us. I'm sorry. I hated that place.
I, David McKillop of the city of Gananoque in the Republic of Ontario, make oath and say who I am. I am a
plaintiff
in this action.
Since Patricia and Marie started their class action suit, former residents of two other institutions, the Rideau Regional Center in Smiths Falls and the Southwestern Regional Center in Blenheim, have initiated lawsuits of their own.
I work part-time at the car dealership in Gananoque.
Well, David, I'm going over it here, and it says,
clean toilet with a toothbrush. Wear
embarrassing
nightgown all day. Kneel and hold a pail of water in each hand for instant improvement of time. They thought I was bad.
Were you bad?
No.
You say here, I couldn't tell anyone about the abuse because I was afraid that the Rideau staff and other residents would abuse me even more.
Yeah, right.
Because here you say you got kicked in the groin.
Yep. Hard.
What they're going through right now, it's hard on us and it's hard on him.
Eileen McKillop holds her husband's hand. Two battle-weary, middle-aged people on a well-worn couch.
But we keep going. We keep doing it until we get what the judge says and whatever the lawyer says. So all I want is just get it relief and get it over with. So it'd be easy for him.
I'd be glad to see it over with.
And keep on going.
Keep on trucking. We got married at my friend's place. Outside wedding.
That's the minister there that married us.
You were in a tuxedo there.
Yes, I was.
And then there's the limo and me getting in the limo.
David and Eileen's place is friendly and crowded. There are wedding pictures on the walls.
Every time Eileen goes by here.
There's Luke the bird, Neil the dog, goldfish in a tank. Like Patricia and Marie, David and Eileen get help from friends, neighbors, and various community organizations when they need it. They manage well, proud of their independence. There's a macaroni casserole bubbling in the oven and a guitar on David's lap.
No picture at all when I was young.
No pictures of you when you were in the institution?
No.
No birthdays, Halloween?
No.
He's like invisible. Since you don't have no pictures, you just like, you don't exist. You usually have pictures of yourself when you're a kid, but him having pictures, that is weird.
Don't want to bring back the memory as much as I can.
But now you're involved in this class action lawsuit against the government of Ontario.
Then standing up for all the people who who would not stand up for himself.
And you're having to remember what it was like being in there.
Beaten up by a staff and sexual assault. That happened to me too. I'm an 8-year-old.
David's stories echo those of Patricia and Marie. The body of evidence is growing.
When we came as boyfriend and girlfriend, that's when he talked to me about that. I couldn't believe it at all. In his dreams, he's always talking to me about get away from me. And no, I'm not doing that. So I have to wake him up. And when he wakes up, I said, "You okay?" He said, "Yeah, I just had a nightmare." I said, "Yeah, I know you did have a nightmare. What do you think I'm waking you up for?"
Some people say I'm goopy. Some people say I am dumb. But if you spend some time with me, you will find I'm feeling free, Lord. Think about people who die in the institution, people who left the place. That's what that song is all about. Lord, carry me away.
Which way out?
We're not supposed to be in here.
Okay, which way do we go out? We're just
trying
to get out.
Whoever even thought of inventing those places, they should have had their head blown off. I shouldn't talk like that, I'm sorry. Because, you know, the damage, too, is that I never grew up with my family. I was like a stranger. But I guess back then they thought they were doing a humane thing. Well, how humane was that?
How far do you think the government would have gotten in the 50s, 60s, and 70s if they had held people convicted of murder by the ankles and dunked them into bathwater full of ice cubes, or forced them to scrub floors with toothbrushes, or kicked them or punched them? If you think about the sort of the hierarchy in terms of where these people stood on the totem pole, they were below convicted felons.
No one from the Ontario government is speaking publicly about these lawsuits. In its statement of defense, the government says Haroni was managed in accordance with the standard of care of the time. That's the way things were done back then. As for Patricia and Marie's stories of being dunked headfirst into tubs of water, of being stepped on, or David being kicked repeatedly in the groin, the government simply says, prove it. Patricia was asked the other day to name the people she says abused her. She came up with a list.
If the government can prove that it took every step to protect these people, then it will be successful.
Kirk Bayart, the lawyer, has been down this road before. He was one of the lawyers on the Indian Residential School case.
If you read the reports that were given to the cabinet decade after decade, it's very clear that that isn't what was happening at the time, and that even though the government was told multiple times by the people it was hiring to do reports, it still didn't listen to those people. The government of Ontario created the conditions under which this all happened, so there's no one else to blame.
Kirk Bayart is now reading through thousands of files. As former residents and their families find out about the lawsuits, they send in their stories. More arrive daily. Some people, like Patricia and Marie, left Haronia decades ago, but their memories are as clear as day. All these years later, there's an air of urgency about this case. People with intellectual disabilities don't usually live as long as other Canadians. The men and women who grew up in Haronia are dying at the rate of about 200 a year. Patricia is 53, Marie is 57, David is 60.
$16.61, $13.95, $16.15, $17.42. $16.23.
Before leaving Orillia, Patricia and Marie visit the Haronia Regional Center Cemetery.
$17.59, $17.87,
Row after row of crumbling plaques lie in the overgrown grass.
I don't think they do a good job of keeping it clear.
Patricia and Marie crawl from grave to grave, brushing away leaves. 2,000 people are buried here.
They're all numbers!
Their names lost in time.
Like, I feel good I didn't die here? What do you think? That's a dumb question to ask. I wouldn't want to be out there at night. 1495, 1724.
For the Sunday edition, I'm David Gutnick in Orillia, Ontario.
1751. If you weren't retarded going in, you were fucking retarded coming back out. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I swore. That's all I have to say for now.
You are listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius Satellite 159. My name is Michael Enright. Last week on the program, we had a bit of fun with something called 11 Sounds Your Children Have Probably Never Heard. Well, maybe a bit too much fun, as it turned out. Many of you wrote in to tell us that you couldn't hear the sounds that your children have never heard because of some background music we added for a bit of flavor. So here we go again with those 11 sounds that your children probably never heard and that you didn't hear last week, minus the music. All right, get ready. Here we go.
Awesome, huh? Sign, sealed, delivered, I'm yours. Sign, sealed, delivered, I'm yours. This is CBC Television.
This concludes our programming for today. Good night.
Hold it. Isn't that wild?
All right, those are the 11 sounds your children have probably never heard. I've never heard of them either, actually. Yes, there were 11 of them. They are in order: a rotary dial telephone, a manual typewriter, a stovetop coffee percolator, changing the channels on a TV knob, on a TV using a knob, or it's a knob changing channels, I don't know what, a gas station bell, a 45 RPM record changer, a record skipping, a manual cash register, an 8mm movie projector, a TV station sign-off, and an Instamatic camera flash cube. There you have it. The 11 sounds without the background music. Now, here is the background music without the 11 sounds. This is the Penny Whistle Song by Leroy Anderson. He's the same man who brought us Sleigh Ride, something we'll no doubt be hearing a lot of in the next few weeks. And that wraps up this first hour of the Sunday edition for the 27th of November. Last week, we had a very enlightening, I thought anyway, conversation about cancer research. In particular, we asked exactly where all our cancer donations go and what we donors can do to make sure our donations are well spent. Well, we've got a flood of mail in response. It seems a lot of you wonder why so much emphasis is put on treating cancer rather than preventing it. We got so much mail, in fact, that we thought we'd better come up with an answer. So, we'll try to do that in our next hour, right after the news and weather. I'm Michael Enright. Don't go away.